Most people think of reggae as warm, laid-back island music, until they hear what King Tubby did to it. In a tiny Kingston studio filled with handmade electronics and scavenged gear, a quiet engineer with a background in radio repair blew open the possibilities of sound. He stripped vocals out, cranked up the bass, sent snares spiraling into outer space, and invented something the world had never heard before. Dub. Not just a style, but a revolution. But here's the part the mainstream won't tell you. Tubby's genius wasn't just about echo chambers and reverb. It was about power. In post-colonial Jamaica, where political violence and poverty collided with cultural pride, Tubby gave a voice to the voiceless by making silence thunder. Then, just as dub was on the edge of global domination, Tubby was murdered in a case that remains unsolved to this day. Was it random street crime? Or was there more behind silencing the mind, behind one of music's most radical movements? So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Frequencies of Rebellion. The stifling heat of the late afternoon hangs over Waterhouse like a blanket soaked in tension and dust. Children run barefoot along potholed lanes. Radios blast ska and rock steady from crooked windows. And behind one small gate on Drumilly Avenue, an electrical hum fills the air, not from a street lamp or a passing car, but from a small shed converted into the most important studio in Caribbean music history. Inside, a man with grease-smudged fingers adjusts a tangle of copper wires on a home-built mixing board. He doesn't speak much, he rarely does, but every movement of his hand, every flick of a knob, is a language of its own. This is Osborne Ruddock, better known as King Tubby. What he's about to do will forever alter the DNA of music around the world. But first, he just wants the snare to sound like it's echoing off the walls of space. The birth of a sonic revolutionary King Tubby didn't come up through the music industry. He came through electronics. Born in 1941 in Kingston, Jamaica, Osborne Ruddock was a man more interested in how things worked than in how they looked or sounded. While others sought to make noise, he was drawn to circuitry, to frequencies, to electricity itself. In his early 20s, he worked as a radio repair technician, fixing broken units, rewiring amplifiers, and quietly building a reputation as one of the most brilliant electronic minds on the island. But it wasn't just radios. Jamaica in the late 1960s was in the throes of sound system warfare, a cultural phenomenon where mobile DJ rigs battled in the streets for sonic supremacy. With limited access to commercial recordings, selectors, DJs, and engineers had to innovate to survive. They needed better amps, deeper bass, louder speakers, and someone who could build or fix them without asking questions. That someone was Tubby. Hometown Hi-Fi and the Rise of Dub. By 1968, Tubby had built his own sound system, Hometown Hi-Fi, which quickly became legendary for its clarity, volume, and customized gear. But Tubby wasn't interested in merely blasting tracks. He was obsessed with what sound could become. At that time, producers like Duke Reed and Coxone Dodd were cutting instrumental B-sides of popular tracks, known as versions, to allow live MCs to toast, rap, over them during parties. One day, while preparing a dub plate, Tubby did something no one else had. He stripped nearly all the vocals out, played with the EQ in real time, and let the rhythm breathe, creating what would become known as the first true dub mix. It was revolutionary. Gone were the boundaries of linear music. With echo, reverb, and faders, Tubby turned songs into space, manipulated time itself, and transformed what was once background filler into a new art form. He wasn't remixing. He was remapping reality through sound. The Workshop, a lab of resistance. Tubby's studio wasn't polished. It wasn't glamorous. It was a converted section of his home, part shed, part electrical graveyard, part spiritual chamber. Here, he created custom-built mixing boards and effects units from discarded military electronics. He rewired amplifiers, built his own high-pass filters, and crafted analog spring reverbs that sounded like storms echoing through the void. He didn't see himself as a musician, but as a scientist of frequencies. And like a scientist, he was unbothered by fame. He preferred the silence of the circuit board to the roar of the crowd, but the crowd was coming anyway. By the early 1970s, producers like Bunny Lee began bringing their rhythms to Tubby for mixing, and Tubby transformed them, not with melody, but with absence, letting drums punch through a sea of silence and snares, linger like a ghost in the room. Suddenly, everyone wanted the Tubby mix, collaborations that redefined sound. It wasn't just one man behind the movement. Dub's rise was a constellation of creative forces, but Tubby was the gravitational center. He worked closely with Lee Scratch Perry, whose Black Ark studio explored Dub's spiritual and chaotic elements. While Perry approached music like a mad alchemist, Tubby approached it like a surgeon, precise, calculated, and obsessive. Then came Augustus Pablo, whose mystical melodica, paired with Tubby's minimalist dubs, created tracks like King Tubby Meets Rockers Uptown, a piece now considered one of the greatest instrumental reggae songs ever recorded. There was also Prince Jammy, Scientist, and a generation of engineers and producers who came through Tubby's workshop. They didn't just learn how to make music, they learned how to build music. This wasn't just reggae anymore. This was science fiction with a Rastafarian backbone. Dub as cultural resistance. What few outside Jamaica understood was how powerful this music really was. In a post-independence Jamaica still reeling from colonial scars, dub became an act of rebellion. It stripped songs down to their essence, just as the people had been stripped of their language, land, and identity. In that void, filled with echo and low-end thunder, new identities were built. Dub wasn't about melody. It was about memory. It wasn't about lyrics. It was about feelings buried too deep for words. And in the absence of the lead vocal, it gave room for the audience to speak, literally, in the case of MCs, and spiritually, for the marginalized communities who danced to these rhythms on dirt floors beneath open skies. The bass wasn't just a sound. It was a heartbeat, steady, grounding, ancient. The revolution would not be televised, but it would be echoed. By the mid-1970s, Tubby's name was spoken with reverence. His mixes were pressed to limited-run vinyls that passed from DJ to DJ like sacred texts. No two dubs were ever quite the same, because Tubby was mixing live, reacting to the energy of the room, the hiss of the tape, the hiss of his soul. Still, he remained mostly invisible to the mainstream. He didn't tour. He rarely gave interviews. There were no glossy photo shoots or press kits. He let the echo speak for him. And as reggae exploded globally, especially through Bob Marley, Tubby's fingerprints were all over the sound. But his name wasn't. Closing scene, the studio after dark. Back in that small workshop in Waterhouse, Tubby flips a switch. The reels turn. A beat drops. But instead of letting it play, he kills the vocal, cranks the delay, and sends the hi-hat spiraling into an infinite loop. He steps back, listens, nods once. It's not music. It's architecture made of air. It's rebellion made of rhythm. It's truth, without a single word. And it's only the beginning. Chapter 2, Dread Bass and Dangerous Politics. The city is tense. Gunfire crackles in the distance like broken firecrackers. Political graffiti scars every wall. Trenchtown is on edge. Tivoli Gardens is under lockdown. And the air hums, not just with fear, but with bass. From battered speakers nailed to wooden poles, dub rhythms pour through the streets like a sonic force field. They're not just entertainment anymore. They're protection, communication, resistance. And behind many of these rhythms, buried under echo and drenched in reverb, is the signature touch of a quiet, unseen hand, King Tubby. But in a country split by bullets and ballots, Tubby's influence was no longer just musical, it was political, and that made him dangerous. The sound system as weapon. In 1970s Jamaica, political affiliation was often a matter of survival. The People's National Party, PNP, and the Jamaica Labor Party, JLP, weren't just ideological opposites. They were street armies. Gangs aligned with either side controlled neighborhoods, enforced loyalty, and waged brutal turf wars. Caught in the middle were everyday Jamaicans, poor, creative, resilient, and the one thing that gave them momentary relief was music. Sound systems became more than mobile discos. They were community strongholds. Partying in a JLP-controlled zone with a PNP-aligned sound system could get you killed. playing a politically charged tune in the wrong area? Suicide, Tubby's hometown hi-fi, despite its neutrality, couldn't escape the environment. His music was everywhere. His dubs were played by both sides, sometimes within hours of each other. His sonic fingerprints danced across enemy lines. But that meant everyone was listening, and everyone had questions. Bass lines that could break windows and minds. What set King Tubby apart wasn't just technical mastery, it was intentional silence. He used bass like a weapon, not loud, but low. So low it bypassed the ears and rattled your ribcage. It was physical, spiritual, and unpredictable. And then came the dropouts, those radical moments where he would mute everything but a snare or kick, sending listeners into momentary confusion before the rhythm returned with even greater power. These weren't studio tricks. They were psychological experiments. To the dancers, it was ecstasy. To rival engineers, it was sorcery. To politicians and power brokers, it was a new kind of influence they couldn't control. What happens when a man who never speaks becomes the most powerful voice in town? Haile Selassie, Spiritual Warfare and Dub's Sacred Pulse. Many of Tubby's collaborators, like Augustus Pablo and Lee Scratch Perry, infused their music with Rastafarian spirituality, a faith rooted in black liberation, anti-colonialism, and the divinity of Emperor Haile Selassie. Tubby, while not a Rastaman himself, engineered the sound of Rastafari. The delay effects mimicked chanting echoes across mountains. The spring reverb simulated distant thunder and judgment. The stripped vocals mirrored meditation and introspection. Through dub, Rastafarian messages reached youth who'd never step inside a Niyabingi ceremony. It made scripture out of rhythm. It turned mixers into altars. Was Tubby preaching, even if he didn't know it? Or was he simply capturing the sound of a people trying to find God in the ruins of empire? Power, envy, and the rise of protégés. By the mid-1970s, Tubby had amassed a quiet empire, recording gear, distribution power, dub plates that could make or break artists. He wasn't rich by global standards, but in Kingston, he was respected and feared, and that power bred jealousy. Up-and-coming engineers like Scientist, Prince, Jammy, and Philip Smart studied under him. Some were welcomed, others were watched. Tubby shared knowledge, but he never gave everything away. He understood that in a city where knowledge was survival, keeping a few secrets was essential. Even close collaborators whispered that Tubby sometimes erased sessions if he felt a track was too powerful for public release. Was he protecting the music or protecting himself? There were rumors that politicians wanted him on payroll, that gang leaders demanded exclusive mixes, that foreign producers tried to buy his gear or steal it. No one could confirm because Tubby rarely spoke. The sound of surveillance. It wasn't just Kingston that noticed. Foreign producers from London, New York, Tokyo began flying to Jamaica, begging for Tubby to mix their tracks. Major labels wanted his secrets. They didn't care about the culture. They wanted the sound. But Tubby wasn't interested in fame. He turned down interviews. He refused licensing deals. He didn't even like to leave his house. Some say he was paranoid. Others say he was just wise, because Kingston was changing. The drug trade was growing. Violence escalated. Politicians became gangsters. Gangsters became politicians. And information, even in the form of vinyl, became a commodity worth killing for. Tubby didn't carry a gun. He carried a soldering iron. But in Jamaica at the time, they might have been equally powerful. The studio becomes a fortress. As the decade closed, Tubby began reinforcing his home studio. Steel grates, alarm systems, reinforced locks. People said he was preparing for something. Others said he'd been threatened. A few said he knew he'd become a target. But still, the rhythms flowed. He engineered hits for Johnny Clark, Jacob Miller, and even Roots rebel Yabby U. His productions grew darker, deeper, more minimalist. Tracks like Death Dub and Dub Fee Guan sounded less like songs and more like sonic warnings. And beneath it all, the low-end hum of something coming. The final decade of the dub dawn. In the early 1980s, Tubby began stepping back. He built a new studio in Duhaney Park. He let protégés like Prince Jammy take over more sessions. He explored digital techniques, but cautiously. The warmth of analog was his sanctuary. By now, dub was influencing not just reggae, but hip-hop, electronic, and punk. Bands like The Clash cited him as an influence. UK producers were mimicking his delays and drops in club tracks. American rappers were sampling his beats without even knowing his name. Yet Tubby remained mostly anonymous. No flashy concerts, no awards, just the sound and the silence. Until one day in February 1989, even that went quiet. Closing scene, a streetlight flickers on Drumali Avenue. Night has fallen. The air is thick with the buzz of insects and the far-off thump of dance hall. In the driveway of his home, Tubby exits his car. It's late. No one should be around, but someone is. A shadow steps forward, a brief exchange, then a single gunshot. Tubby collapses. The car alarm blares, and the echo of that shot will never stop ringing. Chapter 3, Silence, Suspicion, and the Unfinished Mix. There's no music tonight, just the whine of a distant siren, the flutter of torn posters, the dull rhythm of raindrops tapping zinc rooftops. Osborne, King Tubby. Ruddock lies on the cold pavement outside his home, blood pooling beneath his head. His car door still ajar, his keys still in his hand. The man who gave Echo its name, gone in an instant of brutal silence. No one saw who pulled the trigger. No one claimed responsibility. And just like that, one of the greatest innovators in music history was erased. Not by time, not by irrelevance, but by violence. But what if Tubby's death wasn't random? The murder that made no sense. King Tubby wasn't flashy. He wasn't part of any crew. He didn't traffic drugs or run guns. He didn't throw wild parties. He barely left his house. So why would anyone kill him? Official reports chalked it up to a robbery gone wrong. But those who knew Tubby scoffed. He didn't carry cash. His car was a humble Toyota. And his home, though filled with custom gear, wasn't exactly a treasure chest by Kingston's criminal standards. What was taken? Nothing confirmed. What was lost? An entire future of sound stolen in the dark. Theories begin to echo. It didn't take long for rumors to flood the city. Some said it was a hit job, commissioned by a rival producer jealous of Tubby's underground power. Others whispered that Tubby was working on something too revolutionary, a sonic weapon for political use, and someone needed him silenced. Still others believed it was just Kingston randomness, wrong place, wrong time, and a trigger-happy youth looking for a quick score. But there was one theory that never went away, that Tubby had enemies. Quiet ones, rich ones. Ones that didn't leave fingerprints, just silence. Unanswered questions and a missing legacy. No one was arrested. No one tried very hard, and within weeks, the city moved on. But in the music community, the grief was seismic. Artists like Prince Jammy and Scientist gave cryptic interviews, hinting that Tubby was onto something big, that he had recordings no one had ever heard, that he had new technology he refused to share. Some even claimed he'd planned to finally launch his name internationally, with a dub album that would blow everything else off the map. That album has never surfaced. Was it destroyed? Or is it still sitting in some forgotten studio drawer, its reels slowly decaying? Tubby's final message, never played? The digital era and dub's rebirth. In the years after his death, Jamaica plunged deeper into dancehall and then into the digital rhythm explosion. Autotune and MIDI replaced analog warmth. Drum machines replaced live snares. And dub? Dub became a ghost. Heard, but rarely seen. Sampled in London clubs. Resurrected by European producers. Worshipped by niche audiophiles, who hunted for original Tubby pressings like sacred texts. It wasn't until the early 2000s that younger generations began to ask the question, who was King Tubby, and why don't we say his name more? The theft of credit in global music. Let's get brutally honest. Producers from New York, Berlin, and Tokyo built entire careers on techniques Tubby pioneered, yet rarely gave credit. They used dub as a marketing gimmick. They mimicked his dropouts and delays. They studied his waveforms, but they didn't tell the story of where it all came from. The name Tubby was often left off liner notes. His influence erased by race, by region, and by the global music industry's obsession with profit over provenance. Was that part of the silencing too? When you steal a sound and bury its creator, you don't need to pay royalties. The echo chamber of cultural erasure. King Tubby didn't just create dub. He invented remix culture. He birthed the idea of taking something apart and making it new, not just in music, but in media, art, even politics. And yet, his name remains a footnote. How many times have you heard about Bob Marley? How many times have you heard about King Tubby? One sold a message. The other created the language that message traveled on. So why don't we say his name louder? Is it because he didn't perform? Because he didn't pose for cameras? Or because the world wasn't ready to honor a black scientist of sound from a Kingston backroom? The man behind the echo. Those who knew Tubby describe a man of contradictions. He was silent, but expressive. Private, but generous. Obsessive, but playful. He could spend 6 hours tuning a reverb spring to get it to sound like rain in a cave. He could destroy an entire mix because the snare was too proud. He believed in perfection, not because he sought fame, but because he respected frequencies like most men respect gods. He once told a visitor, "Me new play music, me talk to it. It tell me when fi stop, me just listen." Maybe that's the greatest lesson, that the best music isn't what you add, it's what you have the courage to remove. The unfinished mix. We'll never know what King Tubby would have done in the digital age. Would he have embraced it? Would he have built new gear from old trash? Would he have created silent tracks that broke every rule? Maybe. Maybe not. But what we do know is this. King Tubby taught us that silence is power, that echo has memory, and that even when the world kills the messenger, the message loops forever. You can still feel it in the drop of a dubstep track, in the ghost of a trap beat, in the reverb behind your favorite artist's chorus. That's Tubby, still mixing, still echoing, still waiting for the world to catch up.